Team Time.
Welcome to Team Time Table Talks. I'm your host, Debbie Waith, and in this series, I'm going to be speaking with practitioners and experts about working with teams. I'll be discussing what working at the team level means from a practical perspective and how it's affected by increased uncertainty and remote working. My aim in this series is to optimise how we work, think and feel in teams to be more human, hopeful and helpful in our organisations. We'll hear my guests share their real-life experience and expertise in relation to working with teams and get past the soundbites to dig out the learnings and micro-tips that you can try with your teams today. We'll share stories from our practice to help bring our learnings to life, whilst of course respecting our clients' confidentiality. In this episode, I'll be speaking with HR Director Catherine Green, who's worked across many sectors and in several organisations in the field of HR. Catherine is someone who brings a voice of experience, wisdom and challenge to work at the team level, and has been responsible for both procuring the work as well as being part of the work. And she shares her experience both in terms of the role of HR as well as what she's learned in terms of what enables or frustrates this type of work. In our conversation, Catherine reflects how leadership in teams have changed over this last 12, 15 months, and reflected on the conversations that are live right now around future working practices, where the organisational needs are being weighed and measured against individual needs and preferences. And we talk about what is, for me, still an important yet relatively unexplored aspect of the impact at the team level. Catherine reminds us that remote working's always existed, but perhaps the playing field has levelled out more. So how do we build on this? We talk about the impact of working virtually, what's got better as well as the challenges. And Catherine warns us against the temptation to polarise the experience as either good or bad. We talk about the return to work that organisations face ahead of them and the importance of quality endings as we inevitably have to let go of some of what we knew whilst we create some new habits and norms. As we move to focus on work at the team level, Catherine shared her experience of teams and teaming, stressing the importance of purpose for the team, answering the tough questions of why do we need to be together and what value does this team add to the organisation? And she reflects how the purpose shapes how that team interacts and the difference between whether they transact or connect. I asked Catherine when she thought work at the team level was useful and what she's noticed when it's been done well. And we discussed both the form of the work, the key roles in the work, and the relationship between individual development and focus with team development and focus. Finally, Catherine shared a challenge to our facilitator community to be more flexible in how we work. Gone are the heady days of those off-site residentials, and now we're in a space where we need to adapt to the working practices of the teams and to integrate virtual work in this type of work more. I knew this was going to be a conversation I was going to learn a lot from, with someone in one of the critical positions in any team process. And I thought Catherine does a brilliant job in allowing us insight from her role in HR in this process. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I did. And perhaps as you listen to the episode, you can ask yourself, how have you adapted your ways of working to better support your team? And is there more space to experiment with what works? So hi, Catherine. Welcome to Team Time Table Talks. It's great to have you here today and to get to be able to speak to you and hear some of your experience as an HR director and this whole topic of working with teams. So to get us started, can I ask you to share some of your background and a little bit about yourself and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, thanks, Debbie, and it's great to be here. So my name is Catherine Green. I'm currently a director of HR at Thames Water. And as Debbie and I are recording this, this is my day 4 of starting in a new company. I have got over 20 years experience in the HR function, primarily in what I would call business facing HR. So working with client groups to support them on their, you know, people agenda, people journeys, and across multiple industries. So defense, financial services, oil and gas and energy, and now the water industry, which is brand new to me.
Mm. Well, congratulations on the new job, 4 days
in. Thank you. Thank you. Not sure what the new job is yet, but I'm sure it will become clear.
Maybe we'll touch back on this, but I think it's been an interesting time as people have started either new roles in existing organisations or joined new organisations, in how we start well and what it means to transition into new organisations when we're all working largely remotely, if not fully still.
Absolutely, yeah. It's been a very interesting experience to have gone through the whole hiring process remotely,
yeah,
and then to virtually onboard as well. So it's a very different experience than going into the office and meeting a whole load of people to look after you and have a cup of tea or coffee or whatever your tipple is, you know, the first day that you join an organisation. So it's definitely challenges and things to talk through in that respect.
So, as you know, this series is about working with teams and trying to sort of share some of our experience of working with teams. So what I'd like to do is kind of start us with context and just, you know, the yeah. world as it is just now. Then we'll talk a bit more about what do we mean by this work, and some reflections for practitioners, whether it's facilitators or HR leads or leaders in teams, and then we'll end on some common questions I'm asking everybody. The usual heads up that we won't mention any names individually, but of course we want to try share our stories where we can. So for me, one of the reasons I was really excited to have you join the podcast was, in my opinion and experience, I think this work is about relationships. And one of the Absolutely. Most important relationships in working with teams is HR.
Yeah.
And whether that's in the contracting for the work, and not just procurement, but boundaries and understanding what we mean by engaging with teams, but also possibly as a member of a team as well. So I wonder if we could, as I say, start with what's been going on around us. It's been such a year of uncertainty. Yeah. I mean, it's so hard. We've heard it described so much in the last 12 months. It's hard to know which word to describe anymore. But uncertainty, and, you know, just as you described your industry experience, I think one of my reflections is just quite how differently some of the industries or sectors have experienced this last 12 months, with some under extreme pressure, some having to adapt quite radically to survive, and others thriving in, you know, yeah. happen to be the space where they can kind of continue to operate. What's been your experience through this period, and what have you noticed at sort of an organizational level and as a leader through this period?
So I think there's a couple of things, actually. I think, first of all, our temptation as organisations, as leaders, as HR people, has to been to focus on people who are now working from home and not an office. And I think we have forgotten about the people who actually do need to go to a physical place of work, whether that still be the office, whether that be, you know, transportation, whether that be because they're in manufacturing or a, you know, an essential service. And I worry that we have inadvertently created a bit of a them and us in terms of focus and, you know, conversation and energy. And I know there are lots of people who still have to go to a place of work, you know, day in, day out, who feel forgotten and lost. And I think there's a piece of leadership and teaming around that I think will come back and haunt us if we're not quick to start to really address that piece. So I think there's one around there. I think there's a piece around leadership's changed and team working has changed, but not universally. And I think it's more subtle. So, you know, for example, we talk about presenteeism and isn't this great that people have proved that they've been able to work from home? Well, actually, I found that I'm probably more present at my desk and my laptop than I ever was actually physically in an office. And you jokingly talk about, you know, as an adult, if I was in a 4-hour meeting, I wouldn't sit in that meeting for 4 hours. I would get up. I would stretch my legs. You know, I happen to have a bad back. I might actually go make myself a cup of tea, refresh my water. But sat at my screen, I don't feel that that's the right thing to do. And I'm more likely to sit at my, you know, my screen for 4 hours. I think the positive side of that is we focus more on the human element. So we can see into people's homes, and some people are more or less comfortable with that. And we can see into our leaders' homes as well. So I think there's been an increase in humanity. People do have pets, children, caring responsibilities, lives. And I think that has brought work and home, you know, together more tightly. And I think some teams it's helped them really knit more strongly, and in others I think it's probably just shown greater disparity you know, between teams as well. And I would say there's been greater innovation, but I would argue less creativity, because we're all getting very good at using whiteboarding on Team or Zooms and the technology, but that creative bounce that you get from humans being in a room together, I think has been lost. And I do think there's an element of disconnection at the personal level. So, you know, we call it that, you know, water cooler or coffee chat. You know, that's impossible. And so everything feels a little bit more formal, rather than that just informal off the record. Nobody feels off the record on a video chat, even if it is supposed to be just two people talking. So they're some of the things that immediately come to mind as to you know, what I've seen over the last year.
I think you raise a really important and interesting point about we've focused a lot on what has been the probably a majority in lots of organizations of the people that were sent home and, you know, just work from home, and not so much for the people on the people that actually either didn't have that choice or chose something different because of the nature of their role. And it is interesting to think, even as we navigate what will become the new ways of working. And of course, we've got some organizations that have made proclamations that, you know, everybody will have to come back to the office, and others that have said, no, everybody can, you know, work wherever they like. And I guess the bit I've struggled with in that, in trying to understand, you know, that there's an axis that says, what does the organization need? Yes. And that will vary by what the nature of, you know, the roles and the purpose of the organization is. And then what does the individual want across the other axes? And for me, the bit that's the bit that we're not really talking about is what's the impact on the team, and that kind of potential of you're all here for a purpose in this team. You know, I'm making an assumption here that this isn't just, you know, a consolidated group of people that happen to work for one person.
Yeah.
When I say team, I mean there's an interdependent relationship that they have to work with each other to deliver, you know, whatever the performance targets or goals are. What I'm not really hearing much about is how do we navigate this tension, if you like, between what the organization needs, what the individual wants, and what's the impact on the team. And again, I think, and I'll, you know, hold my hand up to this as well, I think I've probably been thinking about it from those individuals that have choice in their, this is what I'd prefer. But of course, there's the set of you know, employees that don't have choice in relation to what they do? And what does that mean in the dynamic for teams where some choices are honoured and some there just isn't a choice?
And I think it's really hard. And I think there are some really obvious delineations where the, you know, the entire team has to go to a physical place of work. That's much easier to manage than when you've got some of the team that has to and some of the team that doesn't have to, or actually where you've got a team and they've all got different preferences. So, you know, as particularly as we start to come back, the balance between, you know, people's perception of risk, you know, whether they want to come back because you know or they don't want to come back because they're worried around you know, commuting or, you know, the spread of you know, disease within the office. People who want to, they're desperate to get out of their kitchen, you know, with their five children running around, you know, or just because, you know, graduates stuck in a teeny tiny flat somewhere, having no space. I think we are going to have to start to have some really honest conversations around what does the business need and what's the personal preference and how are we going to meld those. And I think that actually has to start at an individual level, and then you have to build it and look at it at a team level. So, you know, as someone who's joining a new organization that is starting to bring people back, that's the first conversation actually I'm having, because people want to have it. What are my expectations around, you know, being together physically? And there will be a balance of saying we can be flexible, we can have working, you know, remotely, but actually that is all predicated on the connectivity working well. And if the connectivity doesn't work well, then we have to think again. I think where it does work and where actually it has helped us rethink is for multinational organizations where your team is geographically dispersed, or even actually a UK company where your team is physically based over a number of buildings, where you might have, you know, half the team in one building and the rest are spread out, and the people who are spread out would be at a disadvantage to the people who are in one building and did get together for lunch and coffee. So there's always a flip side. I've really seen this dichotomy as we've moved through. There's always two sides to this. The flip side is we've actually potentially for dispersed teams created a more level playing field, because actually everybody is isolated and nobody is able to have that coffee cooler conversation. And so people who, you know, I've had feedback from individuals who are remote saying this works much better for me because you are no longer all in a room, you know, rattling crisp packets and having side conversations and popping out, and me struggling to follow the conversation. You know, we are now having to have a better etiquette around our dialogue and our connectivity, which has made them feel actually more included. Yeah. So I think for me, the danger is we're in a very black and white conversation right now. Are you in the office? Are you out of the office? Are you at a place of work? You know, are you at home? And actually, I don't think that's the right conversation to have. And with the team, it's got to be actually what's the best dynamics for the team. And you might find actually the best dynamics for the team are to continue to enable significant remote working if you've got a dispersed workforce, as an example.
I think the point that you make that actually this is already present for those remote locations, and there was certainly one of the public sector organizations that I worked with that was a real tension between you know, regional offices with large numbers and, you know, HQ wherever that may be, and whether there was sufficient forethought in terms of how one felt included or not, if you were the only dial-in. And so I do wonder if etiquette changes to consider those remote locations, not because of where they are geographically, because in some ways it's the danger, I think, becomes you start to have a small group who happen to be in the office, and what you don't want to set up is inner, you know, circles and outer circles based on whether you can see people. So it is going to be an important set of conversations. And the bit I have to admit, I'm not 100% landed on is whether you start it at the individual or whether you start it as a team. And in some ways, I'm a little bit wondering, you know, what will it take us to have these conversations with the team?
Yes,
rather than having them didactic, you know, me line manager, you line manager, and then the line manager somehow navigates or calibrates. I wonder if one of the steps that we need to take is to start to experience the kind of complexity of these conversations and our various needs, and landing in whatever way we land as a team rather than what's been negotiated separately.
Yeah.
Because all you need is one person to leave, and that then, or somebody to join, and it throws it. And do we really want the power resting with one person, or do we want to step in and say, actually, we're going to share this, and then we're going to own the choices we've made? And I hope come in with a spirit of openness and learning. So if it's not working, we'll change it, but not because Sharon. You know, that something changed for Sharon, and then something changed for John. And I just wonder where we need to locate those conversations.
And I think it depends on the maturity of the team and how well they already work together. I think if you've got a broken team, a team that doesn't gel well, having that conversation as a team could be quite tricky and could be quite difficult and get quite divisive. I think if you've got a very mature team who can have that, you know, adult conversation, they don't need a leader to preempt it. They will actually, in my experience, they'll go have the conversation and they'll come back and say, we've decided.
Yeah, this is how we're going to do it.
And you go, okay, fine. I think it also depends on the type of team, because, you know, you've got the hierarchical team, as you said, that, you know, is a team in its true sense, but it's created by an organizational hierarchy. You've got a project team who might only come together for 6 months. And then more and more, obviously, we're seeing this sort of, you know, agile ways of working, agile squads. And so you could be, how many teams are you a member of? You know, what's your home team where you're actually having that conversation? Because if I just think myself as a HR practitioner, I am a member of three teams minimum. So I'm a member of my HR leadership team, I'm a member of my team and the people who work for me, and I'm a member of my client's team.
Yeah.
And all those three teams might actually have very different needs of me and where I need to be and how I need to work, and the ability to flex that and understand that and work through as people are, you know, potentially coming back to the office, if we just take that as the conversation that we're having. It is really, you know, really tricky. So, you know, as a HR person, I've got client groups that are completely dispersed, and there's no desire, no appetite to have everybody in one place, because they never have.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, other clients, you know, everybody's going to be here 9 to 5 on a Tuesday because we're going to get together. This is when we're going to run our leadership team. Well, that impacts me. I've got a decision to make to say, to be most effective, I need to go. I need to be there. Or actually, I make decisions and say, well, I'm not, and I'm going to dial in. But I have to understand, you know, what that means in terms of the team dynamics. So I think we've also got to recognise nobody's ever only in one team. It's highly unlikely that people are in one team. And so, as you said, what's the primary team that has to make that decision as to ways of working?
And maybe... maybe it is too clean to think that it's a single set of conversations or it's known decisions. As you were talking there, what the visual that came into my mind was the hive and just the interconnection of all the different parts. And as soon as you adapt or one part collapses, then it affects the others. And so possibly is it about knowing the boundaries and the conditions within those teams that they can adapt, rather so that you can make a choice. You know, perhaps there's some norms around how you communicate them and how you make sure people understand changes, rather than possibly the sort of formality of a decision. Actually, it's an adaptation of a practice, and again, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, an adjustment to thinking those practices are malleable. They have to be. But I also have to adjust because you adjust. And that's okay, because one day you'll do the same for me or another team member. So maybe we have to bring in a different spirit to teaming.
I think so. And it's what is the purpose of that team being together, and what are the issues that you are grappling with? So is there a lack of connectivity, you know, between the team, and is that lack of connectivity therefore best resolved by actually having everybody in the room together? Not necessarily if you put them in a room together and they still don't talk. So going back to that, what is it you want to achieve by having this team together, in whatever together looks like? Is it because actually you know, you do need to come together to problem solve? Is it you need to come together to be creative? Is it you need to come together because actually you've got complementary skill sets? So just personally, you know, just as an anecdote, I'm quite a big picture thinker, and what I've really missed from a particular member of my team is that I was able to sit in a room with them and draw pretty pictures on a whiteboard, and they could articulate what I was actually talking about and make it make sense. And I've missed that. That's much harder to do. So I think you have to come back to, it's too simplistic to say we're a team, or I have a team, and we all need to be together. It's, well, why do you need to be together? What is the purpose of you being together? And then once you've established what that is, what does together look like for this particular team?
So, but purpose first and foremost, why we come together. And all, I mean, it is interesting because it does sound a very obvious thing, and yet it's not always obvious when you work with teams.
We always forget it. We always forget the purpose piece.
Well, exactly. And what is it now? Not what it was when you know, were merged together, or you were you know, somehow reassigned through the organizations. But what is it now? And how? And let's be sort of brutal. It isn't for necessarily you and the team alone to determine that. You usually have stakeholders that want to know that you coming together in this formation brings some value to the organization. So what is that value, and to whom? Again, because there's probably multiple stakeholder groups, and how clear are you on where you bring that value and what's perhaps being impinged by how you're doing it?
I mean, my team last year, when we went into lockdown, we ended up having two different meetings, virtual meetings a week. One was for us, so it was non-work, and we did crazy things. We had virtual bake-offs. One of the team's daughters ran an exercise class for us. You know, we had fancy dress, but it was for us.
Yeah.
It wasn't for a client. It wasn't for a delivery. It was for us to have a sense of belonging, a sense of family, and to keep that connection. And then we had a separate meeting, which was work. And it was absolutely, you know, agenda focused. What do we need to deliver? What's going on, you know, that we need to actually move forward on? And that worked really well for us. And that was a team discussion. It had been one meeting and it got very unclear as to, well, we're all going to dial in at this particular time and this particular day, but, you know, what are we letting ourselves in for? And so actually it was the team's decision that said, we would like to have two very different purposes to our meetings. And that just worked for us. That doesn't work for all teams, but that just worked for us, where we had one silly relief, venting, fun, and then we had one that was, you know, much more, okay, what's on the agenda? What do we need to deliver? So that purpose, as you say, Debbie, is just critical.
Well, and what I take from that is the team recognized the need for connection.
Absolutely.
And not just transaction. And the team kind of were clear enough that they needed to create that. And if it wasn't working in that single meeting, then, you know, I'm sure there's lots of ways it can be adapted. But for you, it worked to split it. But to kind of notice it, I think, is the first thing. And that doesn't always happen. So I think there's something that says, what am I missing in this? Yes. And in some ways, I think there are some teams or organizations who had to flip to the transaction to keep things going.
Yeah.
But over a period of time, and you know, 13 months is a reasonable period, if we're not clear on our sense of belonging, our meaning in the team, our value in the team, our sense of, do you see and hear me? Do you recognize, you know, what might be happening or what my experience behind these walls might be? I think that's so important, but that initial pressure probably meant we went to transaction first. So if it's going to become a more permanent way of working, it's making sure that we do factor in connection as well.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that comes back to your question. Does it come from the team? Does it come back from it? Come from the individual? I think it comes from both. So some individuals will be very quick to say, this is not working for me.
Yeah.
Some individuals will be more slow to say that. You know, some teams will actually come together to say, or some colleagues will say, look, this isn't, it's working for me, but it's not working for whoever else in the team. Yeah. And so a lot of it does depend on the team dynamics that you already, you know, you already have, and what the context is in which you're operating.
I think, possibly one of the benefits of doing this all remotely is that we have had to think more about what's the purpose of this meeting and what's the right format for that purpose.
Yes.
And in some ways that, you know, you knowing that some people, and I'm an extrovert, so, you know, typically as extroverts, we think through talking.
Yeah.
But of course, in the virtual environment, that can very easily sort of sound out, you know, anyone else that might be actually thinking and wondering about the question or the topic. And I wonder if we've got more used to doing polls and mentees and ways to try and check in on how are people, where we're not just prioritizing who speaks fastest, loudest, longest.
I'm not convinced, to be honest. I think there was a curve. So I think, you know, when everybody started working from home, the panic set in, nobody really knew what they were doing. Then I think it settled down. And I think you're right, people were much more conscious around how do I connect in? What's the purpose of a conversation? You know, do I do a poll? Do I do a survey? Et cetera, et cetera. But then I think as time goes on, you know, you slip back into your comfort zone and your previous ways of working. And, you know, I worry that some of that focused thinking has just gone away because we are 13 months in. I think there's a bit of sort of tiredness and well, it is what it is. You know, you can't keep that level of focus up for 13 months. Now, there'll be some individuals, some teams where that new way of working has been become completely embedded, and they are still doing that. But I think from my own experience, you know, some of them have also just slipped backwards, and it enables the quiet voices to disappear and not participate so strongly if, you know, the rest of the team are not aware of that and, you know, proactively pulling them in. And I think the extroverts will pull and put an extra demand on people's time, whereas, you know, other individuals will wait to be pushed. And that's, but I don't think that's actually any different to being together, genuinely, actually. I think, you know, ebb and flow of team dynamics, when you get to a really good place of working and everybody has a voice, everybody works well together, everybody's on it, for want of a better phrase, and then something will happen and, you know, things will just sort of fracture slightly for a couple of months and then it will come back together. So I think sometimes, because this is all new to us, we're layering on problems that I actually don't think are different to the problems we face when we were all together. They're just coming out in a different way, and they're just showing themselves, you know, in a different way. But, you know, everything about connectivity, engagement, quietest voice, loudest voice, you had when you were all together. and yeah. you just probably dealt with them in a different way than when you're all on virtual video.
I think for me, one of the differences is the loss of body language. And, you know, as much as we get, you know, from the chest up, to see, it's the small sort of movements in the seat or the glance. Yeah. So for me, I think, because of course I can glance somewhere else, but you know, I'm only glancing at my own walls. I'm not having the look at the person next to me that communicates quite a lot. And I also think when cameras start to be utilized in terms of on off, and that's not an agreed practice, I think again signals there's something going on, but it can be hard in the virtual environment if it doesn't feel safe enough to even inquire into what's the role of the camera in our in our team. I agree with you. I think there's it's adjustments that we're seeing it, and do people know what they're looking for or know how to respond if something does show up like that? And it brings me to think about when you join a new organization. this is already hard enough when we're in existing
teams.
And we've got those, you know, relationships that some are very much more comfortable, some are much more, you know, generative, and others aren't. And that's human, you know, beings. But how do you join well? How do you make an impact when you join a new organization? And as you say, you're 4 days into working in a new organization. What's been your experience?
It's really tough. It is really tough. And I think it's the cultural nuances that you pick up by physically being somewhere. So, you know, normally, for example, as you go through an interview process and you're sitting in reception, you're already making assessments about an organization and whether it will fit with you or not, just in, you know, how the building looks, how people are as they walk in and out, how they're dressed, how they interact with, for example, you know, the receptionist or security, just how the building feels and works is already giving you a sense of, are you going to, you know, to enjoy this place, or not. And so missing that, I think, is really, really difficult. You know, having lots of introductory conversations over Teams is tiring. So, you know, there is the piece of research that was done in the US around seeing yourself on screen is not good for you. And as somebody who is quite self-critical and is desperate for a haircut, I really don't need to see myself 8 hours a day. And, you know, you start questioning your body language and, you know, things like that. And people are more stilted and still and focused on a video. You wouldn't maintain that level of intense eye contact, you know, in a room having a coffee.
Or lack of movement. You're typically moving to where the energy goes.
Yes, exactly. What I have found personally is, because everybody has already been working like this for a year, they're quite used to it. And so every conversation I've had has pretty much started with, I really feel for you joining us virtually. And so there's an acknowledgement, a real open acknowledgement, and a sort of a forgiveness. It's going to take you longer. You know, it's going to take you longer to meet people. It's going to take you longer to understand, you know, what we do. And I think it's harder when you're meeting your own team members. So I've now met most of my team. Some of them are on leave, and how, you know, you're very conscious as a, you know, I'm coming in as their new boss, you know, as their leader, as their line manager. And so they're all sitting there going, oh my goodness, what's she going to be like? And then you're doing that in the context of virtually. Now, there are some positives in that, I think, because you can show who you are more quickly. So I have two dogs, they run riot at my house. You know, so I already, with one of my team, I had one of my dogs on my knee because she wanted to see them. She's like, oh, I understand you've got two dogs, you know. And so I went, he's small enough to be, you know, held up to the camera. So that actually enabled a personal relationship to be built, you know, much more quickly in one way. So that's a good thing. But the downside is you can't have that level of informality and say, well, let's go grab a coffee, let's walk around the building, or if you've got outdoor space. So it is, you feel more on show, sat very upright still. And the pressure of the technology. So we have horrendous broadband where I live. In fact, we're just doing some community funding to get fiber. And so the pressure of, I'm new to this organization, I'm meeting you for the first time, but I've broken up, you know, you can't hear me properly, I can't hear you properly, it just puts an additional pressure. Is my system going to work? Is it going to hold up? How do I use the technology? So you wouldn't normally be obsessive about, am I going to get a laptop on day one? And do I know how to use their systems? Because you'd be in with other people.
Yeah.
You're at home alone going, oh, I don't understand what this pop-up is and why doesn't this work? And oh my goodness, now my camera switched itself off 30 seconds before I'm about to start talking to the CEO or whatever. So it does put an additional pressure. But personally, I found the flip side of that is people are more forgiving and they understand the difficulties of doing it.
I think one of the aspects when I've spoken to others who've joined organizations this last year is there seems to sort of nearly have been a pause of what life will be like when we go back, in that we don't expect to go back to what we left.
Yes,
and in some ways then we're expecting new faces and we're expecting changed teams and we're expecting changed physical setup. And so in some ways it is the, oh yeah, well you're joining. I think there has been the expectation that things are different now. And I think it's still hard for people to, as you say at the beginning, it's the cultural nuances of what does this organization expect, even if it's not what its posters say on the wall? Like, what's its lived values rather than its espoused values? And how do you learn that when you're sitting in your lounge?
Exactly. And so this sounds really silly, but I went to the office on Tuesday, my first day. And on Monday night, I said to my husband, I have no idea what to wear. I don't know what this place is. Yeah. You know, I mean, interview, you're going to turn up in a suit, probably whatever job you're going for. I actually don't know what to wear to the office. It's, you know, a tiny thing, but actually quite a stressful thing. You know, so it is those nuances that just... the real culture of an organization, as you say, Debbie, not just what's on the wall or the PowerPoint presentation or you know, the thing that you've signed off when you've done your onboarding. How do people, you know...
Well, you say it's a tiny thing, and in some ways it is. It should be insignificant. But in other ways, I mean, I've worked with organizations that are sort of fully suited and very, very smart to... very casual, and there's something that says, do I fit in?
Yes,
so not only do I know what you are, but I'm going to be showing what I am in the absence of knowing what you are. And so you're giving a signal both ways. And so it whilst it should be insignificant, it kind of isn't, because it says whether you get us, whether you are one of us.
And you don't know use of Teams, for example. So that's a system of choice. Is everybody very formal and they all have, you know, scheduled meetings, or are they actually an organization where everybody just pings each other all the time and nobody puts time in the diary? Yeah. You know, you just whack a message on Teams and see if they're there. You don't know that actually without asking that overt question of somebody. And as you say, that psychological safety, you have no trust. You don't know anybody. And so I think what I've felt this week is I've got to be the first to trust. And that is actually my natural style. I'm a very trusting person. I'm sort of, I'll trust you until you show me why I shouldn't trust you. So that is my style anyway. But there are individuals who, you know, are more senior than I am in the client groups, who are my peers, and I'm just having to take that leap of faith and hoping that they're not sitting there going, oh my goodness, who is this crazy woman, you know, coming in, she doesn't know anything, and, you know, she asks some really dumb, you know, dumb questions. But you have no choice but to ask the dumb questions when you can't just sort of take in what's going around you and get the feel, and the, and, you know, you can peep over your shoulder and go, oh no, look, everybody's just pinging on Teams, or at 12 o'clock everybody goes for lunch together and you know, in the canteen sort of thing. That's not there. So I think it does put extra pressure on the joiner to make the first move in a lot of these things. I do think, though, for a lot of organizations, we're talking very positively here, for a lot of organizations who've been through a lot of change and a lot of downsizing and who are requiring their individuals to go back in the office, I worry genuinely about the people who will go back to the offices in some way, even if it's only 2 days a week, 3 days a week, and half their team is no longer there. You know, I left an organization at Christmas. I chose to leave. And, you know, you just went. You know, there was no leaving party. There was no leaving coffee. There was no walking around the building just saying goodbye. You just went. That was strange for me. But I know it's also really strange for the people who are still there. There's no closure. So you've got the starting, but I think you've also got, you know, as people come back and half their team has swapped out or reduced, I think that's going to be really difficult for some teams as well. And I think it's another watch point for organizations that make the decision to, you know, bring more of their people back if they've gone through that quite significant downsizing, because they've had to, because of the effect that the pandemic's had on their, you know, their business model.
I think you know, one of my reflections working in this space, in sort of the OD perspective, is that we typically are more comfortable and put more focus on beginnings, in that we've got a whole heap of policies and inductions and processes, and it's all very exciting. And we don't have that same quality when we end or close, for whether it's individuals or teams. And, you know, I'm sure we both would have stories where the endings haven't been great. You know, some things clearly happened. It becomes one of those elephants in the room that, you know, starts to permeate then and into that whole thing around, you know, psychological safety is a product of a group environment. It's not something that, you know, any leader has the gift to create. It's as a result of, and I think it's going to be important both in the transitions that we've got coming. So how do we agree how we're going to work? How do we reintegrate furloughed workers? Mm-hmm. How do we reintegrate with people who've been working in their environment throughout? And how do we acknowledge some of the endings that have happened to allow us to move forward?
Yes. And I don't think most organizations, in my experience, are good at that. I mean, I've worked for some who are very good when it's big programs. I worked for an organization, I won't name them, where we did outsource an entire part of the business. We had a closing down party, you know, so on the Friday we held a closing down party, and on the Monday the receiving organization had a welcome party, and, you know, the two companies worked together to make sure that would happen. You know, but we are genuinely not, I don't think, very good. Most companies are not very good at that. And I think there is still, in big corporate, I think, I'm not so sure about smaller firms, but big corporate, there's still a bit of, well, you're leaving, you know, never come back. And we've got to change that culture to, you're leaving, go have new experiences, go enjoy, go learn more, and please give us a call in 5 years' time, you know, and bring that skill set and experience back to us. But we still too often don't mark that leaving in a good way for both the individual and, you know, and the team. I mean, it was my choice to leave my previous employer, but my team were devastated. But I was the one that had to do the picking up the pieces for them when I told them that I was leaving. And actually, it shouldn't have had to be me. There should have been support around the team to say, actually, you know, it's okay. No, I was very honest. I was like, I'm happy. I'm in a good place. I don't want you to worry about me. But there was only my voice with them. And I think they found that quite hard. So it's difficult.
I'd also like us to get to a place where we can lose some of what I think is shame when it's not somebody's choice.
Yes.
And so I notice lots of people say, I left, but it was my choice.
Yeah.
And it's like that bracketed bit that says, oh, okay. But of course, there's lots of people where it wasn't their choice, or it wouldn't have been the choice they'd have made at that time or in that way.
Yes.
And, you know, I think there's something about making sure that we are transparent, that the judgment isn't in the leaving, you know, because this is the new world. We're in multiple careers. I mean, you mentioned several industries you've worked in. Mm-hmm. This is sort of my third career. You know, we're all doing that. And I think there's something about, sort of celebrating the ending. Yes, there's going to be something about whether I feel certain on what's coming or not. But perhaps losing some of the sense of, I'm going to say shame, but that might not be the emotion that can go with, but what if it wasn't my choice?
Well, I think there's still, so this is just speaking from a role where I've actually, you know, dealt with a lot of cultures. In a lot of cultures, there's still a stigma if it's not your choice. Yeah. Whether that was, you know, performance or whether that was downsizing, there is still a stigma because we do apply, and a lot of employment frameworks, and this is where I think sometimes employment law doesn't help us do the right things by people, actually. It's something I'm quite passionate about. You know, the legal frameworks are all about, well, how have you scored somebody? How have you made the decision? Where's your evidence? And it drives you down a very negative conversation with an individual as to why they weren't good as the people who are staying. And that's 9 times out of 10, not the reason why somebody is leaving, and it's irrelevant. But that, unfortunately, is the conversation we end up having. And, you know, a lot of cultures still, you know, to go home and say to your family and your friends that you are being asked to leave for whatever, you know, reason is really hard. It's really hard. So I don't think that's just a corporate issue or a business issue. I actually think it's a societal issue where we still have an issue where, I mean, you know, my mother, she couldn't believe that I was leaving. She was like, but why? She just completely could not understand that I was leaving and had no other job to go to. This just freaked her out. She just was really worried. And so I think the stigma piece is much harder than just something that an organization can deal with, but they can help people feel good about how they're moving forward. And, you know, a lot of big organizations obviously will have outplacement services and things like that, but how you thank people for their time and their value that they've brought, even though they're now leaving, I don't think we do very, very well at all. And I think it's something that HR doesn't, in my experience, doesn't focus on. I don't think it helps. It doesn't really have the conversations with the teams and the line managers to say, hey, yes, people are leaving. How are you making them feel? How are you sending them off? You know, we focus on the process. And is the paperwork right? And have we covered risk? And are we going to get sued? And all of that sort of good stuff. And we forget the emotional side, you know, that conversation. Definitely.
Well, there's nothing better than going through your own process of change to give you a sense of what it feels like for people also going through it. So hopefully, you know, in your new role as HRD, you get to kind of really bring in some of these reflections for the wider organization, possibly for people farther down in the organization that might not have wanted to voice what you've seen and experienced as well. And just, you know, always the prospect as we go through this exceptional period of, can we do it better? What have we learned? Can I bring us to thinking about teams? And as you say, there isn't just one team. Many people are part of multiple teams. I believe that teams are kind of the nexus of the relationships and where the work often gets done. Mm-hmm. And so the functioning and quality of those relationships is often really important. Yes, we've also had to shift to figuring out how to do it remotely. But from your perspective as an HRD, when is work at the team level useful?
Oh, goodness. So I think it is when it comes back to purpose. It's a common purpose. Why does this, you know, set of individuals need to come together? So, you know, is that because actually there's a commonality in the work that they're all doing as individuals, and therefore actually you can do it better if you do it as a team because you can share, you can collaborate? Is it more because actually the team just needs to come together, you know, to deliver a very specific output? Or is it actually because it's been falsely created from an organizational hierarchy, and they're the hardest, I think, where actually everybody sits and goes, well, what I do has got nothing to do with what you do, but we're a team, and, you know, yeah, we have to come together once a month for a conversation. Yeah. So I think, you know, the work that's done is very different depending on that team setup. But I genuinely think it's partly there's the unspecified value add of a community, if I can call it that, rather than a team, and actually having people able to, humans are communal animals. So that sense of community and that sense of purpose and, you know, support, you know, and that sort of being joined up with other people, that to me is value in itself, because it makes people more productive, you know, at work. And then there's the actual physical output, whatever that that is, whether that's a short term, you know, we need to create a strategy paper, or whether it's, you know, it's a long term, we all work on a production line together. And actually, if we don't all do our bits in the right way at the right time, then, you know, the thing that we're manufacturing doesn't get made. So I don't think I've really pondered on this, and I don't think there's an easy answer to it.
Well, if I can translate it in my head, then one I think is about the connection and what we get from being part of that community. And the other is what is kind of more the transaction, because it's what the community creates or provides. And I guess then when I think about, so then when we work at the team level, sometimes actually it doesn't have that clarity. Sometimes it's
frequently, well, most of the time.
I think often the focus, you know, if I think to when if I'm contracting for work at the team level, I think often it's talked about as the, what you described as the physical output. You know, we need a clearer purpose. We need to create a revised strategy. But it often becomes quite clear that the reason that bit isn't there already, or is because of the first.
Yeah.
And it's more about what's happening in the community.
Absolutely.
Than what's happening in the transaction. And actually, it's quite an interesting way to frame it, because I think sometimes, sometimes we need to come in through the transaction to
address the community.
Absolutely. Yeah, and create some credibility and trust, so that because that community work isn't always easy work. And I do think there's an aspect that says, okay, the focus is at the team, but each team member has to have an openness to doing work at the individual level as well as at the team level. I wonder if you've got any experience. Absolutely. Or thoughts around the relationship between what happens in terms of teamwork and the individual work from a development perspective.
And I think they have to come together. I don't actually think you can have one, you know, without the other. And if we talk about you know, formal team development interventions, for want of a better word, you know, my own personal experience of when I've seen it work really well is, you know, you start very high level at team and very high level. So, you know, why are we doing this? You know, why are we having someone come in and start to have this conversation with us? That, you know, that's probably done at the team. But then it quickly moves into individual for that sort of more deep dive. You know, where is that individual? What are they thinking about this whole, you know, reason for being? And then it goes back to the team, and then it goes back to the individual again. I've never seen it work well when it's just the team, because it doesn't give each individual the space and the ability to go on their own journey in support of the team's journey. And you know, this sounds a bit trite, but the team really is only as good as its weakest link. And if you've got somebody who's really not that interested, doesn't really want to play, is giving it, you know, lip service, whatever phrase you want to use, then it just won't work. So I think, you know, whether you have an external facilitator come in, whether you're doing it yourself as a HR person, you've got to address both that team need and the individual need, because a team is just a group of individuals. Team doesn't exist without the individuals in it. So that's my view.
So crunchy question. I mean, one of my reflections in this work is that teamwork isn't about performance managing individuals. As in, that's not the right intervention when actually it's already clear within the team, you know, where an issue lies. So I completely resonate with the team, individual. But when you say, if someone isn't interested, doesn't want to do the work, what's your view then as an HRD as to what happens next? Where does that team go from that point?
That is a crunchy question. That's so tough, because there are so many elements that come into play. So, you know, best case scenario, you are able to have a really honest conversation with that individual on why they're feeling like that, and helping them to realize the impact that they have on the team by operating in that way, and having the tough conversation that says, you know, actually this is unacceptable, and you know, we need to have a conversation around, you know, if you're really going to continue to not play nicely, you know, what might be the consequences of that. And I think we too often, as HR professionals, as leaders, shy away from that, and we just sort of expect the rest of the team to carry that very, you know, very specific individual. You know, depending on what the team does, the size of the team, you can sort of mitigate that individual's impact. You can look to lessen it. You know, you can structure their work in such a way that it has, you know, it has a smaller impact, but it will always be there. And you know, my experience is if they're not addressed, over time something else will happen. It will turn into a performance issue, or it'll turn into a really negative team dynamic issue, and that person will get left out, or you know, they'll get excluded.
Or an awful lot of time and money is put into something that actually is equivalent to spinning wheels in mud. And I think there is, so I think for me there's warning signs that say, is work at the team level the appropriate intervention based on an understanding of community and transaction, and what's got in the way to this point? But it takes me to wonder, in your experience then, what's the role of the leader of HR? And I'm saying HR as if they're out of the process. Team members, which might include an HR person, but team members, and then facilitator. Because again, in my experience, they're being clear on whose role throughout the process, not just with this particular example, but throughout the process, it's really important to understand those roles and what they mean in relation to ownership and engagement and, frankly, progress.
I mean, I think it's critical, and I do think there's a critical triangle between the leader, the HR person, and the facilitator. You know, I have a real belief that as a HR person, if you're sitting on that leadership team, you cannot play the two roles of HR and facilitator, and actually the third role of team member. I just personally do not think that's ever a productive use of time, because there's just too many conflicts. So my preference is always either you're outside as HR and you're going to be the facilitator, or actually, you know, you're part of that team and you're in that loop. So I think the team leader's got to want to do it. Interestingly, in my experience, there are quite a lot of occasions where it's just been seen to be the thing to do, and the team leader goes, oh, we need a team intervention. And the most important question any HR person can ask is, why do you think this is the right answer? Because they just come to you going, oh, can you run a whatever session? And unfortunately, again, in my experience, you know, the less strong HR people go, yeah, that's fine, and here's one off the shelf, and I'll go deliver it for you in 2 weeks' time. So that real diagnostic between the HR partner and the leader for me is really, really key. And for the HR person to be really comfortable that they really genuinely understand what the leader is really looking to achieve and why they think this is the right outcome. And for the leader to have been challenged in that thought process so that they're really clear. Because 9 times out of 10, actually, it's not a team intervention. As you say, it is it's an individual issue, or it's actually a leadership issue, or something else that's playing out. I think once you've then got that clarity, that's the time then to bring in the facilitator. And I think, again, in my experience, and you need the facilitator to sort of want this to happen. And if you have a facilitator who doesn't want it to happen, I never think they're the right facilitator for me. Is I'll have an initial conversation with the facilitator, I'll have a joined up conversation with the leader and the facilitator, and then I want the facilitator to speak to the leader on their own, because we've all got slightly different nuances. And there's the formal contracting, this is what this is what we're seeing, this is what we'd like to explore with you, and then the stuff that particularly as a HR person I really want to say to give you the real download of potentially what's going on. And then the leader, I think, needs to have their input as well.
And I guess I would take a similar position from the other seat that says, if I can't speak to the CEO or team leader directly, and everything is sort of through somebody else, that's already a warning sign that says actually, it's got to be not just sort of wanted, but for me, it's so important that you establish some sort of ground rules of how you'll work together. Because I think one of the things, certainly an external I think internal facilitators can do it, but I think it's harder, is we hold the mirror up to particularly the team leaders recognize when, often I think there can be parallel plays that are going on. So we're talking about lack of empowerment, and actually it also feels like lack of empowerment in the room. Yeah. And we can do that in a way, but you have to have that direct trust that says, we're going to go to the edge because that's where we're going to learn what's actually happening. But you have to trust me when we go to the edge. And if I can't speak to you directly, how do we create that? It's too high a risk for each person in that triangle, the leader, the HR, and the facilitator. So I think that those are the three, and in that order actually is really helpful. And then one of the things I look for is, are you as the HRD comfortable for me to have a continuing direct relationship that at times comes back together, but at times is also independent? And if that is a concern, again, that sort of tells me something about what's at play.
I think you're right. And I think you know, the HR model with, you know, business partners being, you know, at the center of everything. And we hear these phrases like, you know, spider in the middle of the web, conductor of the orchestra. You know, it's too easy for, and hey, I'm saying this as a control freak, it's too easy for HRDs to put themselves in that position of control. And that is not the right thing, because also I've just found in my experience, enabling the leader to have that direct conversation with the facilitator, the coach, helps the leader. It doesn't just help the facilitator and the coach understand really what's going on and have that conversation. Yep. It actually changes the leader's thinking in what potentially they thought they were looking for and they thought they wanted. And I think it is hard as a HR person. You do need to know what's going on, but you've got to let go and you've got to trust that if you've contracted with the right, you know, facilitator, that they will bring you back in. They're not going to tell you the entire conversation that they've had with the leader, just as you wouldn't want that facilitator to share with the leader the conversation that you've had with them when you've really dished the dirt, because I do think that's part of the value we can bring. So you've got to hold that that grey area to say, I'm not going to know everything that's going on, because I trust that we've got the right approach for the right things that we're trying to, you know, to do. And you've got to, for me as a HR director, I've got to have that trust with a facilitator that I know they're going to phone me if there's an issue, and they're not just there. And this sounds really awful to the facilitators out there, so please don't get this the wrong way, but not just out there to deliver the contract and take the fee. Yeah. You are actually out there to do the right thing. And the strong relationships I've had, we've been able to have that conversation where the facilitator has actually rung me up and said, look, Catherine, this is what, you know, we designed. This is where we thought we were going to go.
Yeah.
This is not the right answer for this.
Yeah,
for this team, and you know, we either go our separate ways or we recreate and we readjust what the plan is, because you're doing it for the good of the team. And I think if a HRD puts themselves in that position that they're thinking about their place in that triangle rather than they're doing this in service of making the team more, you know, productive, then that's not the right answer.
There's also something just in terms of the mechanics of the process that says you have to have a contract before you start the work.
Yes.
And for me, again, it's one of my personal reflections. Maybe not everyone will agree with this, but I strongly believe that the team have to own the work and have to not just buy into what the leader, the HR director and the facilitator has determined to be the things that they need to work on. Actually, it's an evolutioning, evolving process that can mean that what you signed 3 months back isn't exactly what it turns out to be. And so I think it's absolutely, you know, either write it in so it's got adaptation to start with. And for me, that those initial conversations are all about that, to say, I can't tell you, you know, conclusively what the shape of this is going to be, because we've probably got an inquiry process. We've absolutely got this initial, you know, why are we here at all? What is the work? What would be success for this team in this work? And how would you know? And that is in those conversations. It's kind of that first two parts of the process that you talked about. And then we go back and check in on, does this match the contract enough that we're still within contract? But it comes back to, it's about relationships. And there's something
about trust.
Well, trust, and also for me, I have found that by being open and transparent about who's holding the ownership and engagement, meaning the team, is how we create psychological safety within that environment. Yeah. It's not someone being done to, it's not the facilitator going in, you know, telling the leader what's it's got to be built and trusted. And yes, there'll be some side conversations that people are trying to figure out what's the right next step. But you can't pop that bubble of safety in the work. But I think that triangle, you know, leader, HR, facilitator, the middle of it is the team.
It's absolutely
all in service of the team.
Which is why, you know, you asked me about what order do you have the conversations. I think it is team, individual, team, individual, because you have got to have a team. You've got to say, we're looking at doing this. But then that deep dive, that diagnostic with the individuals, how are they feeling? What are they thinking? And then that sort of broader team intervention, and then checking back in with the individuals, how are they feeling? What have they learned? You know, et cetera, et cetera, is just so critical.
One of my tips has been, so when you say go from team to individual, often the individual is coaching and one-to-one coaching in some form. And one of the things I've learned is just to be really clear that any work at the individual is in service of the team.
Yes.
So it's not entirely, you know, Catherine for Catherine's development. It's Catherine for Catherine's development in relation to this team.
Absolutely.
And that, it may sound small, but it's actually really important so that people can be able to share, so far as they're comfortable, what they're working on and how it helps support the team. Whereas I think if it's coaching and it's only the individual and it's not in relation to the team, they can go down two separate paths unintentionally. And so I think there's just something about making sure there's a thread that weaves through that work.
And I think, you know, that has to be set as an expectation right up front. So, you know, whether it's coaching or not, you as an individual will have these conversations with the facilitator, you know, and this is why you will have those conversations. You know, if then the facilitator comes back, you know, typically to me as the HR person, says, actually, I really think you need coaching as an intervention here, that to me is a different conversation. So it's very rare, personally, in my experience, that coaching has been the right, individual coaching has been the right intervention for a piece of teamwork. There's a piece of coaching, you say, Debbie, that is around you as in the team and how does that work.
Yeah.
But if it's individual coaching, then I think that's a whole different conversation around, well, what's going on with that individual that's the case. The other piece, just quickly, is unfortunately in too many organizations, coaching is still seen as a remedial action. And so even if you've got a high performing team and you're doing a team intervention to get them even more highly performing, go start to talk to individuals about coaching and they're going to freak out and they're going to think that, you know, somebody's looking over their shoulder and they're not doing a very good job and they'll be next for the exit. And that's a shame. I genuinely think that's a shame, but I still think in a lot of big corporates, the easy option for performance management is, well, we'll give somebody a coach. So there's a nuance there about individual coaching as well that doesn't always play out as positively as we might expect it to.
Yeah. So what's been your experience about when, and is there any useful sort of rules of thumb around when can I facilitate as an internal facilitator and when should this work be done by an external facilitator?
So I don't think there are, to be honest, any clear rules around that. I do think it depends on the dynamics of the people that you're supporting, the skill set, the size of the organization. So, you know, my one thing is I genuinely don't believe as a HR person you can be a facilitator and in it. You can't facilitate your own process of which you are part. And too many HR people do.
But it's so interesting. You're like, I'm very clear on this. And you kind of go, well, yeah. But no, it's because you've seen it happen.
It just doesn't work. Yeah. Okay. And it's like, I'm going to be schizophrenic. So now I'm going to be Catherine the facilitator and I'm going to share all of this with you. And then I'm going to be Catherine the team member and disagree with it. I mean, it just doesn't, it's not possible. Do you think as a HR person, I can facilitate another team?
Yeah.
I genuinely believe that if I'm a skilled facilitator, by the way, and not all HR people are, we like to think we are, but we're not. So I feel that I can facilitate another team. I can get, and I have done this. I've got other HR colleagues to come and facilitate. I facilitated other people's teams. I think that's okay. I think it just depends on the issue that you're dealing with and the skill set. And I would always, you know, there is always a budgetary issue, obviously. And, you know, when money is not there, it's easy to ask the HR person to do it. my experience is if it's really, really needed, money can always be found. And, you know, you've got to build the right case. And I'm not saying it's easy, but typically, you know, if the leader really genuinely thinks this is the right thing to do and it's fundamental to this team's ability to increase its performance, then I think both the HR individual and the senior leader should go into bat for the budget to have a professional, you know, come in and support that team. That's my view.
So as you mentioned, you know, all spend needs to be justified and valued, more so probably than ever. How do you evaluate or judge work in the two buckets that we've sort of recognized when we're working with teams, community and outputs, if you like? How do you evaluate or judge it?
It's so hard. And this is a perennial, isn't it? You know, put an ROI on HR, and I think nobody's ever done it to date, really. I think in some teams where there is a discrete output, so it's a product, you know, there's a, you can count the things that are being delivered, whether that's in terms of money or physical assets, I think that becomes quite easy. I think wherever it's more of a you know, office-based, you know, corporate type team, that gets really difficult. And I think it is more nuanced. So you will see things in how the team behaves. You will see sharing, for example, so sharing best practices, sharing information, even sharing people and team members. You know, you will see it come through employee engagement surveys. But I think when it's that sense of community side of it, it is more those feelings. And I think the only way you can really assess that is through those sorts of engagement, you know, engagement surveys.
One of the barometers that I think can be quite helpful is how well team members transition in and out, and how well the wider team helps that team member transition in and out, whether one is operating as a team or whether it's the didactic relationships. Again, it's not easily quantifiable, but it is a qualitative measure that the new team member or the outgoing team member feels. So I think there are, you know, what are the important moments in how we team and whether we value and can find a way to talk about the value of them.
And I think you will also, you will get feedback from other teams, other parts of the organization. Wow, look at this team go. You know, this team's always on it. They're always in sync. You know, they're always together. So actually what I found the most is when you've got a really high performing team, everybody knows about them. And that's really, really powerful. And to your point about joiners and leavers, everybody wants to join. Because they want to come in. So you actually don't need to struggle to hire internally. Actually, you know, people are knocking at your door to say, you know, I want to come and join you. So I think, genuinely believe, high performing teams get a reputation in their organization for being a high performing team. And with that high connectivity, and people want to be part of your family. They want to be part of your friendship group. They want to be part of your community. They want to move house into your street because it's fun and it's, you know, they can get something from it.
There's an energy that draws rather than the energy that repels when we're on a team that just isn't working.
It's not saying we all agree all the time. You know, that healthy disagreement, that healthy dialogue.
Yeah.
And I think that's the good signal. When people are happy to disagree with each other,
yeah,
but it still works, that actually is a really good sign that the team dynamics.
I think Amy Edmondson, in her book where she discusses psychological safety, one of the things that I think is really helpful for people to understand what it is and what it isn't, is that it isn't, you know, the Mary Poppins world. No. It's, you know, real stuff delivered with compassion and care, but we're really clear and can therefore be challenging. It isn't avoiding the difficult stuff. If anything, it's the acknowledging and naming the difficult. That's how we know it's safe, because people trust there won't be negative consequences for just acknowledging it.
Absolutely.
So final question before we move into the closing. So in this work, community outputs, how has it changed, or how should it change for what you foresee ways of working to be going forward?
I think it's going to have to become a lot more flexible. So I think for, you know, physical safety reasons, for budgetary reasons, the days of, you know, let's take the team to this, you know, offsite swanky hotel somewhere, or not so swanky hotel, but, you know, offsite for 5 days. I've stayed in some pretty
you're talking
ropey
a while
places.
Ago.
I have seriously stayed in some pretty ropey places doing these things. But I think that traditional, you know, I call it a residential, you know, residential deep dive, let's just do it all in one go. I think the time for those has gone. And I think it is around, you know, everything we said at the beginning of the conversation, actually, Debbie, so that you know, what are individual preferences? How do they like to work? How do you pull together virtually? Yes, you might need some physical bringing together, but that more innovative, you know, approach. And I think, you know, the professionals in this area, I think, do need to think quite hard around how do you engage, you know, virtually, and not sort of present, you know, the programs that require that heavy, you know, physical presence.
What will be interesting, because I agree, I think it has to shift, and I've seen it move virtually. What I haven't seen is what's coming that will allow sort of more optionality. And I agree with you. I think, you know, it was probably rare that there was still sort of residential and we can get this all done. But I think in some ways it's matching how you work. And the face-to-face was matching how you worked, albeit in possibly a different location. But this is now kind of shifting to say, we don't work that way anymore. If we were to come face-to-face for however many days every month, that would be weird for us now. In some ways, there's something in the, if it's team individual, it's matching the rhythm and cadence and you know, how we are used to working, that I agree. I think there's flexibility and shifts that need to happen.
And if I can be a bit provocative to your practitioner population, so your facilitator population that might be listening, I think it's going to take more work up front. I don't think you'll be able to take your standard toolkit anymore and go, well, this is what we do, and we'll just, you know, we'll dust it off and we'll change.
Absolutely.
Change the name. And I'm purposely being a little bit provocative. You know, I think that upfront exploring, contracting, diagnostics is actually going to take a lot longer and require more time. And then there's the piece around, well, when do you get paid for that because you've got the contract, and when don't you get paid for that because you haven't got the contract? And then I think, again, with the, you know, the relationship with the HR person becomes key. How can they help you fast track that, so that you're not spending a lot of time, you know, non-billable thinking about how you're going to run this intervention? You know, you can get a sense and you can get the rhythm, and you can quickly move to you know, that paid, because I'm very conscious that a lot of people that we use are freelancers, and you only start getting paid, you know, actually probably after you've done 3 weeks of work.
Absolutely.
To win it.
And it's, to be honest though, it's lovely to speak to somebody that talks about non-billable and billable, and just the recognition that that is the life. Equally, it's interesting to hear you say, but more upfront work, you know, putting aside whether it's paid or not paid, but that getting to know you as a team. I mean, I think one of the biggest reflections that I've had, and that I've seen lots of people who come from the sort of facilitator world have had, is that any of this work now, there's got to be so much done in advance. We can't make presumptions that we might have made to respond to when we're in a room with somebody. And there's something about how we engage so that when we are in the virtual room, we're not starting from zero. It's an existing relationship that we bring into that space. So I think that is something that I've seen happening.
Yeah.
But I think when it's applied to teamwork and, you know, even more need for that, for psychological safety, I think there's more that needs to be learned in that space.
Yeah. Yeah. On time ahead.
Well, exactly. So what I've been doing with each of these conversations is ending with a set of questions that hopefully we sort of gather wisdom. So the first one was, is there a micro practice that you could share with our listeners that they could use with their teams that might help improve perhaps their experience as humans in teams, but that they can take away and try today?
And I thought a lot about this one, actually. And for me, actually, it's don't accept the first answer. Because I think whether that's we talk about mental health now, don't we? How are you? I'm fine. But just anything, I think we're too quick to accept the first answer that somebody has given us. And I think when we're working remotely, actually, you need to dig a little bit more into what somebody is saying, whether that's team member to team member, team to leader, leader to team member. I think just, you know, try not just to accept everything at face value.
I think it's, you're reminding me of the distinction between how are you and how are you really?
Yes, exactly.
And what the different, you know, what you elicit in the different question just by one more word or one follow-up question.
Exactly. I think that's critical.
What are you hopeful for as you look ahead?
Besides being able to go for a walk with somebody and grab a coffee, that would be quite nice. That would be good. I think I hope that we can maintain the level of flexibility that we have. And by that, I don't mean that everybody can work from home, but I mean I think there has been a focus on the individual needs and the individual circumstances. And so I really genuinely hope that we can hold on to that and continue to treat people as individuals rather than just as my team or my workforce. And that we can put things in place that are right for the individual, as well as, you know, meeting, you know, organizational requirements. But that's really what I'd like to see us keep.
Well, and of course, you're in a role that in your part of the business that you've got hopefully some of the power to make that happen as well.
Exactly.
So, and you know, to the fellow HR people who might be listening, I think there is something of what's our collective role in sort of transitioning how we work to a better place. Knowing what we know now, you know, we never would have chosen to go through this, but we have, and we've learned a lot. So what can we take with us?
Absolutely.
How can we be more helpful in our teams?
I think this is really difficult, but I think it is, for me, it's two things. It's give people a vision and a purpose. I know we've used that word a lot today, Debbie, but I think that's key. People need to have a purpose for doing things and a vision as to why we're doing it, and then give people space. You know, I genuinely believe most people grow and perform best when you give them the space to do so.
Lovely. And if you could share a favorite poem or a quote or a book that inspires or galvanizes you.
This I found really hard, actually, because I'm not really a quotes type person. So I actually have settled on Becoming by Michelle Obama.
Michelle Obama,
And the reason for that is A, it's just fascinating, and everything that she's, you know, been through, and is clearly never going to stand for President of the United States. But what I like in terms of team is I really took the message, it's all about selecting the right people at the right time for what you need to do, and not being afraid to go get those people and get them rallying around your cause and come work with you or for you, but also then not being afraid to make the tough decisions to walk away when actually that's the right thing to do. So there's a lot of connectivity in her book with people she goes and works for, you know, more than once, or she's worked for, and then she gets them to come and support, you know, Team Obama, as I like to call it. So I actually felt there were some really quite powerful messages in there around team and being very thoughtful as to the right skill sets that you need at that particular point in time, and that emotional connection is critical.
And one of the things that I think strikes me in when I hear Michelle Obama speak is the level of self-awareness and acceptance and maturity to recognize and sort of accept that there's going to be difficult choices to be made, whether it's the pursuing or the letting go, that feels, you know, it seems to be innate in her, in how far but it's really, I think, something that does make a huge difference both to our own experience of our lives and our roles and our work, but also when we're leading others. If we haven't done that work on ourselves, I think it's very hard to be able to do that work with others and for others.
People. Yeah, no, absolutely. It was fascinating read, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Catherine. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I think there'll be lots for people to reflect on, particularly as they think about what the return to work in whatever that looks like. And of course, it's not really a return to work because who stopped? but returns possibly to some physical location in the future or has never left it. So thank you for your time today and your insights.
Thank you, Debbie. I've enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. I hope you find my conversation with Catherine as interesting as I did. After years of practicing, I still learned so much from listening to the experience of others, particularly who wear different roles in this work. And I hope you have too. It's such a privilege to get even a snapshot into the work that people have been involved with. So my thanks again to Catherine for joining me today. Each of these conversations, I think, help move us forward in the quest to do good work, to support teams to become more human and more impactful. And of course, how did you get on with the two questions that you were holding? How have you adapted your ways of working to better support your team? And how do you stay open to experiment and recognise what actually is making a difference? I hope we've given you some food for thought, and would love to hear any feedback that you have. You can get in touch with me on my website, www.debbiewaith.com. And details of how to get in touch with Catherine and any references we've made will also be on the website. I'll be releasing a new Team Timetable Talks every Tuesday. We'd love for these to be accessed by all those who you think would be interested by sharing on your favourite platform. And remember to subscribe to not miss the latest episode. Thanks for listening, and I wish you a hopeful and helpful week ahead. Goodbye.
Subscribe to Team Time.